So I thought I would spend today talking about a couple of quite useful solutions in general relativity, but talking about maybe what you actually see. So a couple of questions that I've had have been about how do you know, you know, what the properties of a metric are, because if you can just change coordinates to make it look really wacky, how do you know that there's any physics in that particular metric? So that's the sort of motivation behind what I'm going to be talking about today. So I'd like to just start off by discussing acceleration versus gravity in the sense of what's the difference between being in an accelerating frame versus in a gravitational field. And then I'd like to sort of take that acceleration theme and look at put a metric up that will look a little bit baffling, like what is it, what does it do? And then we'll see how coordinate transformations, whilst making it in some sense formulaically less neat, are more physically revealing. So just seeing a little bit about how you might prod at something you get to sort of see what it looks like and what properties it's got. So I'm going to look at first, just briefly, looking at an accelerating frame. And so here we're imagining we've got two setups. We've got an accelerating rocket out in space, and then we're looking at the surface of the Earth. So somebody say on top of some mountain or whatever. I mean, so I sort of had a look. Normally it's Alice and Bob, but I actually decided I might send Andres and Ilya up into space because they're always asking me lots of questions. So and then as for the rest of us staying down here, I think we'll have this as Anna and David, since they're your tutors. Oh, dear. Okay, so how would we describe these two situations? So we know from the point of view of the Earth, we're going to approximate it by a Schwarzschild metric. So how would we describe our intrepid travelers in space? So we've seen this a little bit, actually, with the domain wall, but let's, you know, look at it in a bit more close detail. So I'm imagining I'm in Minkowski space-time. I want to look at accelerating frames, and I don't want to think about gravity, so my coordinates are t, x, y, z. So just standard Cartesian coordinates. And so here, the four velocity is cosh, sinh. And so that was why I put the factor of 1 over a there, so that the four velocity had unit magnitude. And then if I look at x double dot, I can see that my acceleration, or the absolute value of the acceleration, is just a, because I've got a 1 over a sitting in the x mu. So this is a uniformly accelerating observer. And if I sketch the world line, simply a hyperboloid. So what we can do is change base to a coordinate system which is centered on our observer. So notice, probably why I chose those guys to go up there, eventually, because the rocket is accelerating uniformly, it's never going to cross this null line here. So eventually, if we're inertial, we're not going to be able to hear what they say. Or rather, they can't hear what we say. It's the other way around. So the rocket, or Andres and Ilya, will actually have event horizons because there's going to be a limit to what they can actually see. So we've got so what can they see? They can see on this side of the line. And then in terms of what they can influence, they can't influence anything down here. So you can see those are the two horizons in for our accelerating observers. So we can encode this by changing coordinates. And so you see when rho goes to zero, we've got something that looks like a horizon. G tau goes to zero. So you recognize from that picture a very similar structure to the domain wall. So it's just building up a sort of set of things, you know, set of tools or patterns that you recognize, and this one is just identifying acceleration. So you can see that I chose those coordinates so that they had an immediate correspondence to the way I'd written down the world line, the coordinates of the world line. So you can see that they sit at rho equals 1 over a, because then that agrees with this x mu. But in our new coordinate system, that's just sitting at fixed radius. So rho, because if you look at the metric, it's just a d rho squared. Rho is representing constant proper distance, or proper distance away from the observer accelerating at a constant rate.
The first one should be t smaller than x, so that they can see t smaller than x, not t bigger than x, I think.
Oh yeah, sorry. Yeah. Is the other one right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Thanks. So let's imagine we've got Andres and Ilya again in the rocket, and I'm centering my coordinate system around Andras, and then I'm assuming, or we are assuming, since you're always sitting in exactly the same place, that Ilya is at a constant distance from you. So that would say it was a constant rho. So actually, if you stay at a constant distance away, your acceleration will be just marginally different, because the acceleration is really the curvature of one of these hyperboloids here. On the other hand, if you've got two observers, both at the same uniform acceleration, then your sketch is going to look more like this, and hopefully I'll manage to get it right. You've got to have the same hyperboloid. Goodness only knows whether I've managed that. We'll soon find out. translated along. And so if this is the case, because the because Ilya's got the same acceleration, Ilya will also have his own horizon in terms of what he can see and what he can influence. But because you've sort of shifted these two hyperboloids, that means eventually they'll go out of causal contact. So that means here is a limit. This is the only part at which Andras can talk to Ilya. And then similarly, I'm going to see my reverse event horizon here. If I look at when can Andras actually see Ilya, it's not until up here. Colors. So obviously this is an extremely exaggerated space-time diagram, but I'm just trying to get across some of the features of the causal picture of what happens with accelerating observers. So that's just some of the peculiarities, or, I mean, obviously, in order to actually get this type of diagram here, the way I've sketched it, these are extreme accelerations, but it's just some feature or something that happens if you've got uniformly accelerating observers in a flat space. So here we say, you say it's confusing, Anna, so you're A primed. Or should we say A plus? So again, I'm just going to write down Anna's coordinates and calculate her acceleration standing on the surface of the Earth. There's only really T dot if you're fixed on the surface of the Earth. And so my T dot, if I want to look at proper time, is going to be proportional, or it's going to depend on the Schwarzschild potential. So here I'm assuming a Schwarzschild metric for the Earth. So we use our geodesic equation, or rather, not the geodesic equation, but the covariant derivative to calculate Anna's acceleration. Because T dot is just a constant, we don't get any contribution from the first term, so all we've got is simply something coming from the connection components. So Anna's acceleration is purely radial, and it's equal to gm on r squared. So that's really like Newtonian result. So the acceleration is just gm on r squared and radially pointing. So if now we ask what happens if someone's just sitting somewhat higher, what happens there? Then we get the same result, but just with a different distance. Put gm on r squared that side. So we have just again a slightly different acceleration. So in both cases, if our observers were a fixed distance apart, they had just slightly different accelerations. But we can look now at what the order of magnitude of these are. So this is of order 10 to the minus 6 times d in meters. But if we look at comparing that with the differential in acceleration between Andras and Ilya, we see that in terms of orders of magnitude, there's actually a radically different order of magnitude. So up at the top, we've got A into 1 minus AD, so it depends on the acceleration, but typically the accelerations are going to be much lower. Actually, did I jot down what I believe the acceleration was going to be? The other main difference is, of course, this aspect about being in causal contact. So if you try, it seems if you're in flat space trying to mock up acceleration, you can do so. However, you end up with a different causal picture. In a gravitational field, you can have this relative acceleration, or you can have the same acceleration, but you remain in causal contact. So if Anna and David wanted to have precisely the same acceleration, then David might have to accelerate a little more strongly. He might start moving away, but they would still remain in causal contact. So these are the sort of differences. And then, of course, the main difference, which is what we learn about when we're talking about when we first think about general relativity and then think about what happens for gravitational redshift and observers in a gravitational field, it's really the tidal forces, the fact that the acceleration shifts as we move around in space, that is the main difference between the gravitational field and the uniformly accelerating observer. So the reason I wanted to talk about acceleration was to emphasize that you can write flat space in a variety of coordinate systems. Sometimes it looks curved, sometimes you get horizons, but it's really still flat space. And this very special example of a uniformly accelerating observer is called Rindler space. So the next example I want to talk about is acceleration and gravity. So I want to look at something which represents now an accelerating solution like a Rindler space, but it's not flat, and it's where we're accelerating a more familiar type of solution. However, we're going to start with something distinctly non-obvious. Right, this doesn't look particularly, it's not very friendly as a metric. Mm-hmm. So it's something, you can see that from the point of view of its structure, it's written down in a just as in a formulaic way, in quite an isometric fashion. You've got, you know, an dy over this splits into ty and x psi. You've got polynomial functions here. You've got, you know, something that looks like a Schwarzschild, f dt squared dy squared on f. So there's parts of it that have a structure that's familiar. You've also got this overall conformal factor involving both x and y. But although it has some familiar aspects, it doesn't really look, other than the fact I've rather tellingly written down 2gm here, it doesn't look like anything physical or sort of anything familiar or anything sensible. So in this case, how do we sort of start picking it apart? So the first thing is to notice, as you know, as is common, so we do have killing vectors. We've got a d by dt and a d by d psi. So we've got two killing vectors. And then I'm going to tell you that psi is a periodic coordinate. But I'm not telling you what the periodicity is, because actually we can choose it to be what we want it to be. And we'll try and look to see what is a sensible choice to make. So, next question, what are the ranges of our coordinates? What makes sense? So if we want to have our metric to make sense, we've got to have f and g being positive. So we need to have a plus dt squared and minus all of the spatial coordinates. So if I just sketch what the what g of x is, it's a cubic, so it can have three roots. If you look at its value at x equals 1, it's negative. At x equals minus 1, it's positive. But if 2gm is quite small, then you know these roots are going to be quite close to plus and minus 1. So I'm just going to note that g is equal to minus f of minus x. So, you know, if I look at the structure of one, I've got the structure of the other. So that tells me that I need to be looking at this range for g, or possibly way over to the left-hand side. But given that this psi is periodic, if I think about what happens for the two-sphere, in the two-sphere I've got d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. And so if I imagined my x was cos theta and ignored this 2gm, then this would look like dx squared on 1 minus x squared. So I can see that if this parameter gm or a is 0, then I've got a two-sphere sitting in my x psi direction. So that tells me, if I want to interpret those last two coordinates as part of some spatial section, it's giving me a strong steer that I need to lie between these two roots here. So if I label them A, B, and C, it suggests that I need to take my x coordinate to lie between those two roots. So similarly, if you think about what f is, well, f is just take g of minus x, so we flip it around and then invert it. And so it's telling me that my f is going to lie in this region, but of course, I've flipped the sign of my x, so it's actually between minus b and minus a. So having just thought about what's the range of my coordinates, that's made me notice that the function looks a little bit like a sphere here, but it's distorted. And if I'm looking at what these two roots are here, one is close to one. And if I ask, where is this root out here? If I think about what is the root, it's something which is quite large and negative, but I've imagined that this parameter here is small, then a large and negative root is going to come when my x is minus 1 over 2 gma. And so that's sort of sounding like something going to 2 gm. So my y coordinate looks like it has a limit which is roughly 1 or 1 on 2 gm. So if I were to say a black hole event horizon was r equals 2 gm, then that suggests that we try a coordinate transformation that r is 1 over ay. So if I take 1 over ay, then this root will look like r equals 2 gm. Again, this is only approximate. I'm just looking for the orders of magnitude of the roots of this cubic. So it's just looking at that, it's just suggesting a coordinate transformation. So if I do that, tells me what my dy has to transform into. And then f of y is going to be minus 1 plus a squared r squared minus 2 gm over a squared r cubed. So I can pull out a factor of 1 over a squared r squared. To get something rather familiar. So having made that coordinate transformation, suddenly the whole structure of the metric becomes a lot more familiar. If I look at what's inside the brackets and just focus on the T and R parts, I see I've got something that, a potential that we've already seen, and we've seen it in the context of Schwarzschild-De Sitter black holes. Now, it's not a Schwarzschild-De Sitter black hole because what I wrote down is actually a solution to the vacuum Einstein equation. So there's no cosmological constant at all. But again, you've also, you can see, although it's sort of slightly different structure, you can see at least, again, some analogies with the Rindler space or an accelerating observer, in the sense that you see that there's a horizon here as R comes to of order 1 on A. So, you know, whether it's acceleration or De Sitter, you've got a similar type of structure sitting there. So we have two horizons. So here, I think, you know, what I've done is by making a coordinate transformation, I've written the metric in some different form, but a form which is more familiar and more comfortable, so that we feel that we can correctly identify the two singularities, the two coordinate singularities. One of them is just our sort of a black hole horizon, and the other we're identifying as the as an acceleration horizon. So we just return, what we want to do is return to our x and psi, again looking at thinking about x equals cos theta, we can see that it looks roughly like a sphere, but not precisely a sphere. So what we'll do, again, we've got two coordinate singularities. We've got one close to x equals 1 and one close to x equals minus 1. If this were a sphere and we didn't have this GMA in that G function, we would say x equals cos theta, and we wouldn't even worry about the North Pole and South Pole singularities because we'd say, we know how to deal with that. We're not even going to think about it. So here we've got a North Pole and a South Pole, but because we've changed our metric function, we can't just assume that those are okay, that they're just locally regular. We have to actually go in and look at what's happening at our sort of new North Pole and new South Pole. So in each case, we have to check that our metric is regular. So what I'll do is I'll first look at what happens just near B, say. So near the South Pole, my g function looks like some constant, the gradient of b, times x minus b. So now we've seen this again, it's again reiterating this technique of looking near singularities. So if I look at what my new angle, so I'm imagining that I can define some sort of theta angle here. So if I'm defining it proportional to the square root, so if I look at d theta, I'm obviously going to get 1 over the square root, and then I square it, so I've got this expression here. But I see that this is roughly dx squared over g of x near x equals b. So I've redefined a coordinate that looks locally like a proper radius. So it looks like our usual polar singularity, but it's only true if psi has the right periodicity. So near this south pole root, or theta b, you can see that your g of x d psi squared is roughly g prime x minus b d psi squared. But then I can see that I can write this x minus b as theta squared over 4 and so it tells me that if I want to identify a phi angle, then this is what I have to do. So this would have periodicity 2 pi. So why have I gone through a bit of a song and dance and emphasized that this is what you're having to do at each pole? Well, if I look at what G primed is, so G primed is minus 2x minus 6 GMA x squared. And so if I look at my G primed at both roots, I actually see that g primed of b is not equal to g primed at c. So in other words, if I choose the periodicity of my psi coordinate to be regular at one pole, it's not regular at the other pole. So roughly speaking, g prime to b, x is roughly minus 1. So you see this is roughly 2 minus 6 gma on this side, whereas the other side where x is plus 1, this is roughly 2 plus 6 gma. So you can sort of see the difference. It's of order this gma parameter. So what does this mean? Is this something that means we're going to throw our hands up in despair and say, oh, well, the metric's bad because it's singular? Well, actually, we don't, because what this tells us is that our periodicity of psi is not quite 2 pi. And so what this is a conical singularity. So a conical singularity is something that's extremely intuitive. You take a sheet of paper, you cut out a little wedge, you re-identify, and what you end up with is a space. This is a conical singularity of pi, a space that is an exact cone. So if you imagine taking on the plane r squared and cutting out a wedge, delta phi, here, and then re-identifying, you would have a conical singularity at the origin. So you could either write this as a flat space metric with delta psi equals 2 pi into 1 minus delta, or you would write it with a coordinate phi, which was identified with periodicity 2 pi, but with a modified metric function. So in the first case, you would ask, the key feature of a conical singularity is that the circumference of a circle at constant r is not 2 pi r. So that's the key feature. In the first case, you achieve that by your angle not running from 0 to 2 pi. In the second case, you achieve it by having a pre-multiplying factor in front of the r squared, the part of the metric. So that's what a conical singularity is. However, we do have a physical solution which gives a conical singularity in the sense that it looks roughly like a conical singularity at large scales. What you're really doing is you're taking the conical singularity and smoothing it out over a short scale. So this solution is known as a cosmic string, and it's got many similarities with the domain wall that we saw. Our domain wall was an example of a topological defect where we had distinct vacua, so we had disconnected vacua. A cosmic string forms when our vacuum has non-trivial U1s, so non-trivial circles. So you're doing the standard model, so you must know about this sort of simple abelian Higgs model. And so it arises So I'll just sort of give a rough indication of how it arises. So rather like the domain wall, we have this non-trivial potential. Our vacuum value of phi is not the origin, so we have spontaneous symmetry breaking. But in this case, instead of our phi being a real field, it's a charged field, so it has a U1 symmetry. So our potential for the phi field has this Mexican hat type of structure. And so our solution for the string looks something like so just like with the wall where you interpolate between different vacua, here the notion is that if you move far enough away from a fixed axis, you wind around this vacuum. And so as you move in, you have to come over the vacuum and you encounter some energy density. So it's the same notion. You can't write these F and P functions down in terms of clean analytic functions like a tanh or something, or a sech, but they can be found quite straightforwardly, numerically, and you can prove that, you know, you can give an existence proof for them. And so this is quite a useful solution, and it was called a cosmic string because it was originally used to try and give an alternative to inflation for structure formation. So there was this notion that there might be cosmic strings out there. And in fact, they're still sort of not, although they don't give us the structure we see, it's still possible to have cosmic strings out there. They're believed to be a relic of a sort of superstring form of inflation. So it's one of those things where if you do cosmology, you have to at least be open to the fact that there might be cosmic strings out there. So it's, although we've got conical singularities in this metric, we don't worry about them too much because we know we can smooth out the conical singularity with some known solution. So it's not a singularity that we worry about because we don't have our tidal forces blowing up as we approach the singularity. So what's the solution that I've written down? It's got features of a black hole, it's got features of acceleration, and it's also got these conical deficits, but only on one side. So I can make my metric regular, at least on the south pole, but then I get one of these deficits at the other pole. So what we've actually got physically is this metric represents a black hole which is accelerating off to infinity and it's actually pulled by a cosmic string. So these cosmic strings, just like the domain wall, the energy momentum tensor of the domain wall was proportional to the induced metric on the domain wall, the energy momentum tensor of one of these cosmic strings is proportional to the induced metric on the string world sheet. And so the string has a very strong tension. And so this, the interpretation is it's the tension of the string that's pulling this black hole off to infinity. So that's the physical picture here. And the acceleration, if you sort of notice there, the difference between those two G primes is proportional to GMA. The heavier the black hole, the bigger the difference, the stronger the conical deficit, or the bigger the acceleration, the bigger the difference, the stronger the conical deficit. And so that translates here, if you think about it, if something's moving faster, then it's being pulled harder, which means the tension has to be stronger. You've got to be giving it a bigger pull. And so that would tell you the tension. If the tension's bigger, the conical deficit's bigger, which again is completely consistent. If I've got a heavier black hole, then that means it's going to take more effort to pull it at the same rate. Heavier black hole, more effort to pull. Again, I need a bigger tension. Again, a bigger deficit. So this all kind of fits in together. So this is what this metric represents. It's called the C metric. And if you maximally extend the space-time, what you kind of see, this is more of it's a semi-cartoon. Yes, it is a cartoon. It's not a causal picture. So what it looks like, this is my accelerating black hole. And then you continue across the acceleration horizon, and you see that there's another accelerating black hole in the completely causally disconnected region. So this is a cartoon of what the C metric looks like once you extend across the acceleration horizons. And so why this C metric is useful is if I Euclideanize, what I get is now a tube, a black hole, and then this is just again, this is, I can use this, if you remember, I can build up, this is a vacuum solution, I can build up solutions by patching things together. As long as something's Ricci flat, I can add extra dimensions to it. So if I then add now a T, what I end up with is a black ring. Again in 5D. So this kind of, I mean, I'm obviously, this is a very much just a schematic for how you construct these solutions, but essentially this process allows you to construct new vacuum solutions in higher dimensional gravity. And this has been one of the most interesting developments of the last decade or so, is realizing that not only do you not have unique topology of event horizons in higher dimensional gravity, you kind of saw that with Kaluza-Klein black holes because you had the black string. You end up with the black string, you could rationalize it away saying, oh, but that extends off to infinity. So if I want something asymptotically flat, I don't have to worry about that. But you can add in this black ring. This is a solution to five-dimensional gravity. You can see it's isolated. So you can see it's going to be asymptotically flat. But it definitely does not have spherical topology. And then, again, once the dam is bust, people then constructed solutions that look like Saturn's black holes with black rings around them. So it ends up, this metric, which was put forward in the 60s, I think it was the 60s, by Kinnersley and Walker, didn't have so much of an application. It was interesting, notion of an accelerating black hole, but at the time there was no physical way of interpreting conical singularities. Here there's a sort of rotation to get rid of the conical singularity. But now, once we sort of got a much wider encyclopedia of solutions that we have a good physical interpretation for, this C metric has kind of come back in to have quite a few applications, one of which, via a somewhat circuitous route, has given us quite an interesting story about topology of horizons in higher dimensions.